Perhaps you all have read or heard that crack, excuse me, that ecstasy is the new crack. Has anybody heard this? Ecstasy is, you know, a club drug. It's a drug in very widespread usage among middle class, upper middle class, and white citizens, white residents of our community. It's very popular. Recently, we've been told by public health experts and law enforcement experts that it's very dangerous, that there are, it constitutes a profound public health threat. Well, I just want everybody to watch and see what happens. Will we see the type of law enforcement and criminal justice concentration on ecstasy that we saw on crack throughout the 80s and the 90s? And if we don't see that, why is that? Because we're being told now that there's no substantive reason to distinguish between those drugs in terms of the harm that they do, both to society and to the individual user. The Seattle Police Department, which I do have reason to commend on a number of grounds, the Seattle Police Department recently did an undercover buy bust operation in a rave, a huge party in which ecstasy was in common circulation and arrested 40 or more folks for delivering ecstasy, which is a drug of comparable seriousness to cocaine in terms of our legislative judgments, to cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine. Many of those arrestees were middle class, and most were white. They were medical students, aspiring professionals, people who never expected to be in the criminal justice system, and whom, frankly, many in the criminal justice system never expected to see there either. And when this new initiative was brought, the Seattle City Council was briefed on it, and the police department came and described what they had done and what the results were, and that they could have arrested as many people as they wanted to. 40 was an arbitrary cutoff based on their resources. It was like shooting fish in a barrel, the same way that they described buy bus at 2nd and Pike downtown. In other words, there's just no limit to the yield that you could get in terms of arrests if you wanted to focus there. A member of the Seattle City Council questioned the police representatives who were making this presentation and said, come on, is this really a productive way to be using our public resources? Are these really the people we need to be going after? And I mention this only because I do think there's something to the thesis that it's all of our fault and that it's not terribly productive to focus on law enforcement decisions as if they took place in a vacuum. They're decisions that take place, they are riding the surf of a large ocean, and that ocean is community and public preferences and the way that they're expressed to policymakers and the way that they're expressed in terms of pressure on the department. If that doesn't change, it's both unreasonable and futile for us to expect that police decisions are going to change in a vacuum or in a void. I want to end by also trying to put into question the framework that we seem to be moving toward, where yes, once you get into the criminal justice system, you may find more therapeutic options available to you than has been the case in the past. This is the movement toward more drug courts, greater drug courts that encompass more kinds of cases, treatment in lieu of jail, treatment in lieu of prison. These are looked at compared to what we had before. These are welcome developments, and we shouldn't just gloss over that. And they do reflect, in a sense, a sea change. Nonetheless, there's still the access point for that is still getting arrested. And those who never get arrested, as I said at the beginning, never get the benefits of the criminal justice system. If that's how we're going to do things, and if we're not going to change who gets arrested for drug offenses, we are creating a two-track, separate and unequal, way of addressing people's drug usage and drug involvement and drug activity. One is for people who are the focus of law enforcement. They get treatment increasingly, but it is with court supervision, with the threat of jail or prison if they relapse. And it is with the stigma of an arrest, and it is often it is accompanied by a criminal conviction, usually a felony conviction, which, as you'll hear later in the day, carries unending collateral consequences for your ability to get and keep employment, go to school, and get public benefits. Okay, but they're in treatment. The rest of the world gets to go to treatment on their own. And if they relapse, they just go get back in when they're ready. Though it is true that recent studies have shown that so-called coerced treatment within the criminal justice system is not less effective than voluntary treatment, the same studies show that it is not more effective than voluntary treatment. You don't have to put people in that system to see them succeed. What you do have to do is make sure that they have access to the resources to pay for it. Right now, the only place... Right now, the only place in our society where there are subsidies provided to the extent that you don't have to pay anything to get into treatment is once you've been arrested and charged with a felony. That ought not to be the case. So I'd just like to close by saying that though maybe it's nobody's fault coming into this room, once we know what's happening, once we know what we're doing, once we know the human outcome of those choices, if we keep doing it, then it is intentional. It is a choice. It's a choice we don't have to make, and we're all responsible. Thank you.
So now I'm going to start with Dorothy and ask Dorothy to share her story with us and enlighten us about some of the effects of the war on drugs.
First, I'd like to say thank you, and it's truly a blessing to be here because this time 2 years ago, I was sitting in federal prison, not knowing my fate, sentenced to 20 years because I wouldn't snitch on someone. Never sold drugs, never used drugs, never even know what crack cocaine would be without reading about it. But my name is Dorothy Gaines. I'm from Mobile, Alabama. I'm a 44-year-old single mother. And truly, it's a blessing to be here because my first plane ride was with the federal marshals on my way to federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut. And as I sit on the plane now, I thank God that I can ride at my own will. Truly, it was a devastating chance getting here last night. Started out at 12 o'clock yesterday from Mobile trying to get here. Was due here at 4 and got here like almost 5, 3 something this morning. But I know God has a mission for my life. My case starts back. My case could go on. I could talk about this for 15 hours, and I know I have a time limit. But I'm so blessed to see so many attorneys and so many people that come out for this cause. I don't like to use the word race. I don't like to use the word war. And I never really faced racism until I got in the judicial system and when I went to federal prison. If it was there, I didn't know it's because I was a person that I love everybody. I don't see color until you come to close the cars. But I was back in 1993. I was Kamala husband to a guy that was a drug user, and by me being a licensed nurse technician, I didn't want to just put him away because he was a drug user, just to end the relationship. So I did what I could to help this guy, and I put him into drug rehab, and he relapsed. And what happened was a case come down with my oldest child father, Natasha, who's now in pre-law behind what happened to me. She's now starting to be an attorney. My daughter, father held a grudge against me for years because I tried to get child support out of him. I was young and naive at that time and in love, and I found out you could go to prison for being in love. But he held a revenge against me for years, and he had a case to come up on him with guns and weapons and drugs. And I was dating a guy named Terrell, which was my common law husband, so he decided he wanted to get revenge at both of us, so we both went to prison. How this case started out was a state case, and there was no evidence in our case. It was just only word of a conspirator. And the case was state, they threw the case out. So the federal government picked it up. But they asked me to come downtown and testify against Terrell. And I told them I didn't have any information, that I feel like the government should do their own job. I wasn't going to be a snitch for them. So they told me that if I didn't testify, that I would get indicted. So being naive to the law, I took this as a joke. I went back home. And on this, Terrell went to trial in February. And on the end of April, I saw the FBI. They had come to my house in 93 and tore it up and found nothing. come back to arrest me and say I had been indicted by the grand jury. So I went downtown, and they gave me a lawyer, and I have respect for lawyers. I'm not going to tell you that I don't, because through God, I had gotten a pro bono attorney out of Boston that took my case back in 99 that fought to help me get out of prison. But this lawyer that was in Mobile, I called him a public pretender. This guy actually held my hand for me to get convicted. And how this started out was that he didn't do anything for me for the trial. He knew it was a dry conspiracy, but he wanted me to help the government. And I told him I couldn't help the government. So he said that, well, what you got to do is plead out. I said, I'm not going to plead to something I didn't do. So I went on the trial, and the only time I saw this attorney was the day of the morning of the trial. He walked into the room and said, come on and plead. I said, I can't plead. So he first told me, he said, you know, you're going to have a good chance because here we are in Mobile, Alabama, and all your character witnesses are white. So that looks good for you in Alabama. So I goes to trial, and he told me that he had never heard of a guy testifying for a person that wasn't with him anymore, which Terrell was indicted. They wanted me to testify against him. So I went, so they in turn indicted me and asked Terrell to testify against me. So we went to trial, and the government said, well, you're going to testify against her, we'll give you 50% of your time. He said, no, I'll take my time to the door. I'm not going to lie on her. So we went on the trial, and the government still called Terrell to testify against me. They put him on the stand. And then he told them that she didn't know anything about my conspiracy. It was my child's father that implicated me, testified against me and his mother. His mother done 5 years in federal prison as well, so he could get out of prison. So we went on to prison, and Terrell told him that, no, she didn't do anything. I'm going on to the door at my time. And all this started back, and I went to prison, and I said, well, I'm going to go to prison. I'm going to be like the person in the Bible. I'm going to fight this case. And I ended up getting a lot of publicity. I was in Playboy magazine. I was on PBS Frontline Snitch. I was in Essence magazine. I was in Marie Claire. I was in Jet. I was in People. I hit about 20 newspapers around the world because I wanted people to know this. It just didn't happen to me. It can happen to you as well. And it was just a miracle case in the courtroom. My lawyer said, well, I know you're going to make sure that you get this time. He was really the prosecutor. I thought he was my attorney, but he was the prosecutor. So after I was convicted that day, I asked him, I said, you know, my mother's dying with cancer. I have two children at home that don't. I'm their only living parent. Could you please try and get me a bond? He said, no, I've never heard that a prosecutor, that you would get a bond if you didn't help the government. So I wrote a letter to the judge and asked this judge to give me a bond to go home and see about my dying mother. And the judge called me in with the U.S. with the marshals. He said, Dorothy, I took your letter for a bond, a motion for your bond, and I'm letting you go home today. My lawyer reached over and told me, he said, Dorothy, you taught me something. This has never happened before. So I went on to prison, I went on and got bond, and I fired this public defender. And there were some people that raised me, some white people that raised me in the country when I was a young girl that started my needs being met. They got me an attorney. But what we don't realize is that if you don't get it right with the trial, it's no help during the after the conviction. You know, and I went on the trial, and I tell you, it was a devastating thing that I went on to prison. My mother died 6 months. I got there in Danbury, Connecticut. And I never could come back home because I didn't have the $4,000 to come back for the funeral. So I ended up, my case went worldwide with NPR radio station from around the world, and everybody started writing. Everybody started calling everybody, and I started getting mail. And I gave hope to the people that I left behind. Because when you see a grandmother in prison, her daughter and her granddaughter, because the son refused to take the blame, and he put his own family in prison, that hurts to leave an 81-year-old grandmother there fighting. So I asked all the attorneys, if there is some way you can do is try and do some pro bono cases. Try and do something to help some of the people that I left behind. Because it's a struggle. Now it's like the prison after the prison. I was telling Mr. Gossett, so much happens. Here it is coming up Christmas. My purse got stolen last week. Everything I got was gone. I mean, it's like the devastation. I can't get a job because I'm a convicted felon. I can't work in nursing because I'm a convicted felon. And just last week, my daughter came to me, and she's now 18. She was 11 years old when I went to prison. He said, Mom, I want to tell you, I was molested while you was gone. If you had been home, this would never have happened to me. My son tried to kill himself 3 times while I was in prison. And my son now still goes to the drum, still trying to kill himself because he feel like he can't bring back what he's lost. I went to prison because I refused to testify on somebody. I hear people talk about being an addict. I never done drugs, so why should I have to go to prison and get help? I never sold drugs. There was no help in the prison system. Yes, there is a drama going on in the prison system. There's a war, a legalized slavery, because we got people incarcerated making 12 cents an hour for the job that you would do on the street for $30 an hour. And that's why the prison population is high booming right now, because we are having people that are working, making cable lines, making computers for jobs that should be out here for us today. Yes, you get this knowledge in prison as being a computer specialist, but when you come out, I can't hire you because you are a convicted felon. I can't vote. I can't do anything. So all the doors are still closed in my face today, but I still have the spirit to go on and struggle and still fight for the people that I left behind, praying that one day somebody would give me a job. I had no house when I come home, no housing, no money, no nothing. But I thank God for my freedom. I thank God for President Clinton releasing me, because it was on the faith of God. And people say, well, you know, Bush had got, I feel like God, when he in control, he would have moved Bush to release me as well. And that's the way I feel about the system. You know, and I look at the prosecutors, I look at the task force, I look at the police department. What we don't realize is everybody got a day to meet God. And when we mistreat people, regardless of you white, black, green, or purple, I might not see it, but I wouldn't want what I've done to you hurt you to follow my children or my children's children. So I ask people to be careful how you treat people. You know, don't just lie to get a case put in the court. You know that I lost everything, not only me. I speak for the people I left behind that are in the same situation. I had a girl that called me. He said, Dorothy, my daughter was 7 years old when I went to prison. Now my daughter's 19 years old. She serves 30 years because she wouldn't testify on her boyfriend. And I commend seeing so many young people here. I tell you, be careful of your surroundings. Don't get caught up being in love. Don't get caught up because of who you're with. Your family will turn on you. The federal system is, you don't have to have evidence in federal prison. One person can say you had knowledge of. One person can say that you knew about it, and there will be a case brought you. You could face at least lifetime, and there is no parole in federal prison. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dorothy. That's an incredible story, and we're definitely blessed to have you here and have you on our side now. Now we're going to hear from Cliff Thornton. Did I get that right, Cliff?
That's right.
Okay.
I want to thank Andy Coe and all the other people that invited me here to talk to you about what is probably the most important social problem we will ever face in our life. I'm going to take you on a journey, my personal journey, about this drug war. As Elizabeth Taylor said to her seventh husband, I won't keep you long. Racism, classism, terrorism, and the war on drugs are inextricably parts of one huge lie. One cannot effectively address one part without addressing the others. I want to tell you about a journey that took me from a staunch drug warrior to a kinder, gentler, compassionate, truthful person advocating legalization, medicalization, and decriminalization. This journey began for me in 1963, 2 weeks before I was to graduate high school. One Sunday morning during breakfast, there was a knock at the door. Upon exchanging the usual pleasantries, my grandmother instructed me to accompany the gentleman. He was a police officer, and he drove me to a field of abandoned cars. Under one of them, there was a body of a naked woman. She was my mother, who had died of an apparent heroin overdose. Now, there's no words to describe how I felt, but one thought resonated as I came to my senses, and that was all illegal drugs should be eradicated from the face of the earth. The decades flew by. I watched the civil rights movement take center stage. Onward and upward was the battle cry. I watched the dismantling of the black community as I knew it into an even greater class divide. I watched as the findings of President Kennedy's Blue Ribbon Commission on illegal drugs went unheeded. They said that if the drug problem stayed in the hands of law enforcement, it would make the drug business more profitable, and enforcement would be concentrated in marginalized areas. They determined that drug use is an issue of public health, not law enforcement, and should be handled that way. I watched when I returned home on leave from the Army to bury my grandmother as race riots raged in my native Hartford, Connecticut. I left one war zone only to return to another, where the smell of marijuana was almost as strong as the tear gas. I watched as President Nixon declared the war on drugs on January 17, 1971. A few years ago, Dan Baum wrote a book called Smoke and Mirrors, which described these events very well. In the diary of H.R. Haldeman, one of Nixon's staff persons, Nixon is quoted as saying, "You have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to." And he said this about the Jewish population. And he's talking to H.R. Haldeman. He says, "You know, it's a funny thing. Every one of those bastards that are out for legalizing marijuana is Jewish. What the Christ is the matter with the Jews, Bob? What is the matter with them? I suppose it's because most of them are psychiatrists." Go figure. Gil Scott Heron, poet, singer, and composer of that time period, came up with a very catchy phrase about Nixon's staff, which went like this: "Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean. It follows a pattern, if you dig what I mean." Now, over three decades later, with Bush's staff, we have Ashcroft, Rumsfeld, Powell, and Rice. Not a damn thing has changed but the rollers of the dice.
Go ahead.
I watched as the French Connection became the Bolivian Connection, and then the Colombian Connection, and later the Afghanistan Connection, which will soon become the Uzbekistan Connection. I watched prisons fill up with drug offenders, most with black and brown faces. I watched as our health, education, economic, and criminal system started to falter. I watched as two federal agents came to my place of employment and arrested one of my supervisors. I've known this guy for 10 years. This guy didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he didn't even have a girlfriend. Come to find out, he was introduced to a drug dealer, unbeknownst to him. The drug dealer gets busted, and in order for him to get leniency, he has to finger X number of people.
That's right.
He's now doing 10 years.
That's right.
For bullshit. That next week, September 1997, I could no longer watch and not try and make a difference. I retired from my job. I have since dedicated my life to ending drug prohibition. Now, many people ask, why would you want to legalize something that killed your mother? Now, that gives me a real opportunity to explain in very real terms. I can say I watched as she used, watched as drug use and addiction stigmatized her and the crowd that she ran with. I can say I watched as my mother prostituted herself. I can say I watched her sleep all day. I can say I watched her hustle all night. I can say I watched her abandon my three brothers and me. I can say that it took some time to evolve to the state I am right now, and it was drug prohibition that killed her. To understand this war and to understand the problem of heroin in particular, one needs to grasp one core fact. Virtually every assertion testified to by the majority of politicians, criminologists, and medical personnel are unsupported by any sound evidence. Indeed, nearly all of it is now directly and entirely contradicted by tons of research from all over the world. The first casualty of this war is the truth, and yet after nearly 9 decades, this war continues. Shouldn't we be listening to the many voices which are now saying that continuing this drug war will be a grave threat to the long-term health of this nation? Drugs and fear go hand in hand. The war on drugs is frightening, but not in reality for the reasons which are claimed by its generals. The untold truth about this war that has now sucked in every country in the developed world creates the very problem which it claims to solve. The entire strategy is a hoax with the same effect as an Air Force which bombs its own cities instead of its enemies. We have to go to the trenches of the DARE program to find generals who have been so incompetent, so dishonest, so awesomely destructive toward those who they claim to care for. Executive Director Glenn Levant said of the studies against DARE, "Scientists tell you that bumblebees can't fly, but we know better. Besides, if we only reach one child, it's worth all the effort." Now let me ask you who are parents out there. Would you accept a math, English, or geography program that reaches only one child? I don't think so. The core point is that the death, sickness, and the so-called moral collapse which are associated with Schedule I drugs are in truth generally the result not of the drugs themselves, but of the black market on which they are sold as the result of the strategy of drug prohibition. The classic signs of social exclusion among addicts are the product not of their drug, but of the illegality of the drug. If addicts fail to work, it is not because heroin has made them work shy, but because they spend every minute of the day hustling. If addicts break the law, it is not because the drug has corrupted their morality, but because they are forced to steal and pay black market prices. If addicts are thin, it is not because the drug has stripped away their flesh, but because they spend every last cent on their habit and have nothing left for food. Over and over again, it is the black market which has been created by the politicians which does the damage. In comparison, the drugs themselves are relatively safe. We could turn around this epidemic of illness, crime, and death if we would only legalize, medicalize, and decriminalize them. We have to repeal this failed second prohibition. The moment the price of illegal drugs plummets, drug profits will collapse, and with them, the drug empires. I advocate regulating drugs, governmental constraints on sale to minors, or communities controlling these sale of drugs, quality controls to curtail overdose and prosecution of the inevitable bootleggers. Legalization is the precursor to regulation and control over drugs through state clinics and/or stores. I say, legalize marijuana outright and tax the hell out of it. Make this available in state stores and also sell tobacco and alcohol out of these stores. We're always talking about sending the wrong message to our children. These stores would be the only place one could purchase these substances. This would cut the access tremendously for our children. Remove heroin from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2 so doctors could prescribe and administer cocaine and heroin to addicts and counsel others who are thinking about using. This could be done at clinics. Using in public would be outlawed, just as drinking alcohol is in most places today. Advertising would be strictly prohibited. Driving, flying, piloting a vessel under the influence would still be punished. Taxes on marijuana would pay for enforcement, education, rehabilitation, research, jobs, training, and so forth. these monies would and should go back into those areas hardest hit by this drug war. After all, it is a problem created and sustained by the very laws themselves. Legalization would lead to an immediate decrease in murders, burglaries, and robberies. Though the spread of powerful weapons in the U.S. society and the proliferation of youth gangs has led to an addiction to gun violence that will not soon go away. But many predict that it would cut the illegal gun market in this country in half overnight. Cheap drugs would mean that most addicts would not be driven to crime to support their habit, and that drug lords would no longer have a turf to fight over. Legalization would remove the glamorous Al Capone-type traffickers who are role models for the young, and it would destroy the cool status of drug use. Drug legalization would cancel the corrupting role of drug cartels in South American politics, a powerful incentive to corruption at all levels of our own government, and a dangerous threat to our civil liberties through mistaken enforcement and property confiscation. It would scuttle a multi-billion dollar bureaucracy whose prosperity depends on not solving the drug problem, but perpetuating it. Some people argue that legalization represents a daring and risky experiment, but it is drug prohibition that is the daring and risky experiment. However, it is contemporary heresy to say this, and so the overwhelming evidence of this war's self-destructive futility is exiled from almost all public debate now, just as gay rights, slavery, and segregation once were. Take away the lies and the real danger becomes crystal clear. Not drugs, but the black market, which has been created directly by the policy of prohibition. If ever there is a war crimes trial to punish the generals who have gloried in this slaughter of the innocent, the culprits should be made to carve out in stone. There is no drug known to man which becomes safer when its production and distribution are handed over to criminals. Our problem is not the drug dealers or the drug cartels. They are just opportunists. Our problem is the self-righteous legislators in Washington and the apathetic non-voting public who create the opportunity for those dealers. Anyone who supports our present system of drug prohibition is directly responsible for these drugs in our school, these AIDS in our communities, and the creation and continuation of vast criminal empires. Heroin, marijuana, cocaine present no threat to me or to anyone else who chooses not to use them. But the illegality of these drugs presents a clear and present danger to everyone. Legalization of these handful of illegal drugs won't immediately remove the problems of drug abuse or drug addiction, but it will confine that problem to the people who choose to use these drugs. Then, and only then, is when the real work starts to solve the problems of drug abuse and drug addiction. That will make life better for everyone, and it's a reason for everyone to tell our politicians to end the hypocrisy, the partisanship, the divisiveness, the corruption, the racism and classism and cowardice that has characterized America's war on drugs. Thank you.
You've been listening to a forum on race, class, and the war on drugs recorded earlier this month in Seattle. On the foreign war front, rank-and-file military personnel have been told to be ready to ship out to attack Iraq on January 15th. Meanwhile, a recent dispatch from the trenches of the war on terrorism at home.
coffee, tea, or should we feel your pregnant wife's breasts before throwing you in a cell at the airport and then lying about why we put you there? By Nicholas Monahan. December 21st, 2002. Published on lourockwell.com. This morning I'll be escorting my wife to the hospital where the doctors will perform a cesarean section to remove our first child. She didn't want to do it this way, neither of us did, but sometimes the fates decide otherwise. The fates, or, in our case, government employees. On the morning of October 26th, Mary and I entered Portland International Airport en route to the Las Vegas wedding of one of my best friends. Although we live in Los Angeles, we'd been in Oregon working on a film and up to that point had had nothing but praise to shower on the city of Portland, a refreshing change of pace from our own suffocating metropolis. At the security checkpoint, I was led aside for the, quote, inspection, unquote. That's all the rage at airports these days. My shoes were removed, I was told to take off my sweater, then to fold over the waistband of my pants. My baseball hat, hastily jammed on my head at 5 a.m., was removed and assiduously examined. Quote, anything could be in there, sir, unquote, I was told after I asked what I could hide in a baseball hat. Yeah, anything. Soon I was standing on one foot, my arm stretched out, the other leg sticking out in front of me a la a DUI test. I began to get pissed off, as most normal people would. My anger increased when I realized that the newly knighted federal employees weren't just examining me, but my 7.5 months pregnant wife as well. I'd originally thought that I'd simply been randomly selected for the more excessive than normal search, you know, number 50 or whatever. Apparently not, though. It was both of us. These are your new threats, America, pregnant accountants and their sleepy husbands flying to weddings. After some more grumbling on my part, they eventually finished with me and I went to retrieve our luggage from the x-ray machine. Upon returning, I found my wife sitting in a chair crying. Mary rarely cries, and certainly not in public. When I asked her what was the matter, she tried to quell her tears and sobbed, I'm sorry, they touched my breast and... That's all I heard. I marched up to the woman who'd been examining her and shouted, What did you do to her? Later I found out that in addition to touching her swollen breast to protect the American citizenry, the employee asked that she lift up her shirt. Not behind a screen, not off to the side, no, right there, directly in front of the 100 or so passengers standing in line. And for you women who've been pregnant and worn maternity pants, you know how ridiculous those things look. I felt like a clown, my wife told me later, on display for all these people with the cotton panel on my pants and my stomach sticking out. When I sat down, I just lost my composure and began to cry. That's when you walked up. Of course, when I say she told me later, it's because she wasn't able to tell me at the time, because as soon as I demanded to know what the federal employee had done to make her cry, I was swarmed by Portland police officers instantly. Three of them cinching my arms, locking me in handcuffs, and telling me I was under arrest. Now my wife really began to cry. As they led me away, she ran alongside. I implored her to calm down, to think of the baby, promising her that everything would be all right. She faded into the distance, and I was shoved into an elevator, a cop holding each arm. After making me face the corner, the head honcho told that I was under arrest and that I wouldn't be flying that day. That I was, in fact, a menace. It took me a while to regain my composure. I felt like one of those guys in the Gulag Archipelago who, because the proceedings all seem so unreal, doesn't fully realize that he is in fact being arrested in a public place in front of crowds of people for what? I didn't know what the crime was. Didn't matter. Once upstairs, the officers made me remove my shoes and my hat and toss me into a cell. Yes, your airports have prison cells, just like your amusement parks, train stations, universities, and national forests. Let freedom reign. After a short time, I received a visit from the arresting officer. Mr. Monahan, he started, are you on drugs? Was this even real? No, I'm not on drugs. Should you be? What do you mean? Should you be on any type of medication? No. Then why do you react that way back there? You see the thinking? You see what passes for reasoning among your domestic shock troops these days? Only wackos get angry over seeing the woman they've been with for 10 years in tears because someone has touched her breast. That kind of reaction, love, protection, it's mind-boggling. Mr. Moynihan, are you on drugs? His snide words rang inside my head. This is my wife, finally pregnant with our first child after months of failed attempts, after the depressing shock of the miscarriage last year. My wife, who had been walking on a cloud over having the opportunity to be a mother, and my anger is simply unfathomable to the guy standing in front of me, the guy who earns a living thanks to my taxes, the guy whose family I feed through my labor. What I did wasn't normal. No, I reacted like a drug addict would have. I was so disgusted I felt like vomiting, but that was just the beginning. An hour later, after I had been gallantly assured by the officer that I wouldn't be attending my friend's wedding that day, I heard Mary's voice outside my cell. The officer was speaking loudly, letting her know that he was planning on doing me a favor, which everyone knows is never a real favor. He wasn't going to come over and help me work on my car or move some furniture. No, his favor was this. He decided not to charge me with a felony. Think about that for a second. Rapes, carjackings, murders, arsons. Those are felonies. So is yelling in an airport now, apparently. I hadn't realized, though I should have. Luckily, I was getting a favor, though. I was merely going to be slapped with a misdemeanor. Here's your court date, he said, as I was released from my cell. In addition, I was banned from Portland International for 90 days, and just in case I was thinking of coming over and hanging out around its perimeter, the officer gave me a map with the boundaries highlighted, sternly warning me against trespassing. Then he and a second officer escorted us off the grounds. Mary and I hurriedly drove 2.5 hours in the rain to Seattle, where we eventually caught a flight to Vegas. But the officer was true to his word. We missed my friend's wedding. The fact that he'd been in my own wedding party, the fact that a once-in-a-lifetime event was stolen from us, well, who cares, right? Upon our return to Portland, I had to fly into Seattle and drive back down. We immediately began contacting attorneys. We aren't litigious people. We wanted no money. I'm not even sure what we fully wanted. An apology? A reprimand? I don't know. It doesn't matter, though, because we couldn't afford a lawyer. It turned out $4,000 was the average figure bandied about as a retaining fee. Sorry, but I've got a new baby on the way. So we called the ACLU, figuring that they existed for just such incidents as these. And they do, apparently, but only if we're minorities. That's what they told us. In the meantime, I'd appealed my suspension from PDX. A week or so later, I got a response from the director of aviation. After telling me how, in the aftermath of 9/11, most passengers not only accept additional airport screening but welcome it, he cut to the chase. Quote, after a review of the police report and my discussions with police staff, as well as a review of the TSA's report on this incident, I concur with the officer's decision to take you into custody and to issue a citation to you for disorderly conduct. That being said, because I also understand that you were upset and acted on your emotions, I am willing to lift the airport exclusion order, unquote. Attached to this letter was the report the officer had filed out. I'd like to say I couldn't believe it, but in a way I could. It's seemingly becoming the norm in America. Lies and deliberate distortions on the part of those in power, no matter how much or how little power they actually wield. The gist of the report was this. From the get-go, I wasn't following the screener's directions. I was, quote, squinting my eyes, unquote, and talking to my wife in a, quote, low, forced voice, unquote, while, quote, excitedly swinging my arms, unquote. Twice I began to walk away from the screener, inhaling and exhaling forcefully. When I completed the physical exam, I walked to the luggage screening area, where a second screener took a pair of scissors from my suitcase. At this point, I yelled, quote, what the blank is going on? This is blank, unquote. The officer who'd already been called over by one of the screeners became afraid for the TSA staff and the many travelers. He required the assistance of a second officer as he, quote, struggled, unquote, to get me into handcuffs and then for, quote, cover, unquote, called over a third as well. It was only at this point that my wife began to cry hysterically. There was nothing poetic in my reaction to the arrest report. I didn't crumple it in my fist and swear that justice would be served, promising to sacrifice my resources and time to see that it would. I simply stared. Clearly, the officer didn't have the guts to write down what had really happened. It might not look too good to see that stuff about the pregnant woman in tears because she'd been humiliated. Instead, this was the official scenario being presented for the permanent record. It doesn't even matter that it's the most implausible-sounding situation you can think of. Quote, hey, what the goddammit, they're taking our scissors away, honey. Unquote. Why didn't he write in anything about a monkey wearing a fez? True, the TSA staff had expropriated a pair of scissors from our toiletries kit. The story wasn't entirely made up, except that I'd been locked in airport jail at the time. I didn't even know anything about any scissors until Mary told me on our drive up to Seattle. They'd question her about them while I was in the bowels of the airport sitting in my cell. So I wrote back, indignation and disgust flooding my brain. Quote, while I'm not sure, I'd guess that the entire incident is captured on video. Memory is imperfect and on everyone's part, but the footage won't lie. I realize it might be procedurally difficult for you to view this, but if you could, I'd appreciate it. There is no willful disregard of screening directions, no explosion over the discovery of a pair of scissors in a suitcase, no struggle to put handcuffs on. There's a tired man early in the morning unhappily going through a rigorous procedure and then reacting to the tears of his pregnant wife, unquote. Eventually, we heard back from a different person, the guy in charge of the TSA airport screeners. One of his employers had made the damning statement about me exploding over her scissor discovery, and the officer that had deftly incorporated that statement into his report. We asked the guy if he could find out why she'd said this. Couldn't she possibly be mistaken? Quote, oh, can't do that. My hands are tied. It's kind of like leading a witness. I could get into trouble, unquote. Then what about the videotape? Why not watch that? What, that would exonerate me. Quote, oh, we destroy all the video after 3 days, unquote. Sure you do. A few days later, we heard from him again. He just wanted to inform us that he'd received corroboration of the officer's report from the officer's superior, a name we didn't recognize. But he wasn't even there, my wife said. Yeah, well, he's corroborated it, though. That's how it works. Oh, and we did look at the videotape. Inconclusive. But I thought it was destroyed. On and on it went. Due to the tenacity of my wife in making phone calls and speaking with relevant persons, the, quote, crime, unquote, was eventually lowered to a mere citation. Only she could have done that. I would have simply accepted what was being thrown at me, trumped up charges and all, simply because I'm wholly inadequate at performing the kowtow. There's no way I could have contacted all the people Mary did and somehow pretend to be contrite. Besides, I speak in a low, forced voice, which doesn't elicit sympathy, just police suspicion. Weeks later, at the courthouse, I listened to a young DA awkwardly read the charges against me. Mr. Monahan, shouted obscenities at the airport staff. Oh, they took some scissors from his suitcase and he became, abusive at this point. If I was reading about it in Kafka, I might have found something vaguely amusing in all of it. But I wasn't. I was there, living it. I entered a plea of nolo contendere, explaining to the judge that if I'd been a resident of Oregon, I would have definitely pled not guilty. However, when that happens, your case automatically goes to a jury trial, and since I lived 1,000 miles away and was slated to return home in 7 days, with a newborn due in a matter of weeks, you get the picture. No contest it was. Judgment, $250 fine. Did I feel happy? Only $250, right? No, I wasn't happy. I don't care if it's 12 cents. That's money pulled right out of my baby's mouth and fed to a disgusting legal system that will use it to propagate more incidents like this. But at the very least, it was over, right? Wrong. When we returned to Los Angeles, there was an envelope waiting for me from the court. Inside wasn't a receipt for the money we'd paid, no. It was a letter telling me that what I actually owed was $309. State-assessed court cost, you know. Wouldn't you think your taxes pay for that, the state putting you on trial? No, taxes are used to hire more cops like the officer, because with our rising criminal population, people like me, hey, your average citizen demands more and more, quote, security, unquote. Finally, I reached the piece de resistance. The week before we'd gone to the airport, my wife had had her regular prenatal checkup. The child had settled into the proper head-down position for birth, continuing the remarkable pregnancy she'd been having. We returned to Portland on Sunday. On Mary's Monday appointment, she was suddenly told, "Looks like your baby's gone breech." When she later spoke with her midwives in Los Angeles, they wanted to know if she'd experienced any type of trauma recently, as this often makes a child flip. As a matter of fact, she began recounting the story, explaining how the child inside of her was going absolutely crazy when she was crying as the police were leading me away through the crowd. My wife had been planning a natural childbirth. She'd read dozens of books, meticulously researched everything, and had finally decided that this was the way for her. No drugs, no numbing sensations, just that ultimate combination of brute pain and sheer joy that belongs exclusively to mothers. But my wife is also a first-time mother, so she has what is called an untested pelvis. Essentially, this means that a breech birth is too dangerous to attempt for both mother and child. Therefore, she's now relegated to a C-section, hospital stay, epidural, catheter, fetal monitoring, stitches, everything she didn't want. Her natural birth has become a surgery. We've tried everything to turn that baby, acupuncture, chiropractic techniques, underwater handstands, elephant walking, moxibustion, bending backwards over pillows, herbs, External manipulation, all to no avail. When I walked into the living room the other night and saw her plaintively cooing with a flashlight turned onto her stomach, yet another suggested technique, my heart almost broke. It's breaking now as I write these words. I can never prove that my child went breech because of what happened to us at the airport, but I'll always believe it. Wrongly or rightly, I'll forever think of how this man, the personification of this system, has affected the lives of my family and me. When my wife is sliced open, I will be thinking of him. When they remove her uterus from her abdomen and lay it on her stomach, I'll be thinking of him. When I visit her and my child in the hospital instead of having them with me here in our home, I'll be thinking of him. When I assist her to the bathroom while the incision heals internally, I'll be thinking of him. There are plenty of stories like this these days. I don't know how many I've read where the writer describes some breach of civil liberties by employees of the state, then wraps it all up with a dire warning about what we as a nation are becoming, and how if we don't put an end to it now, then we're in for heaps of trouble. Well, you know what? Nothing's going to stop the inevitable. There's no policy change that's going to save us. There's no election that's going to put a halt to the onslaught of tyranny. It's here already. This country has changed for the worse and will continue to change for the worse. There is now a division between the citizenry and the state. When the state is used as a tool against me, there is no longer any reason why I should owe any allegiance to that state. And that's the first thing that child of ours is going to learn. That was Coffee, Tea, or Should We Feel Your Pregnant Wife's Breast Before Throwing You in a Cell at the Airport and Then Lying About Why We Put You There, by Nicholas Monahan, published on December 21st, 2002 on lourockwell.com. Nick Monahan works in the film industry. He writes out of Los Angeles, where he lives with his wife and, as of December 18th, his beautiful new son.
We'll close the program today with something different than our usual theme, something that seems a fitting anthem for the year to come. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Jesse Lind, Chris Sturr, Sean Ewald, and me, Lynn Gary. We are solely responsible for its content. Here's Ethan Miller with Declaration of War.
Times of war, the folk singers are supposed to write peace songs, go to candlelight vigils and lead all the people in sing-alongs. Say make love not war and have no vengeance on your enemies. Meet violence with love and hatred and anger with empathy. Now don't get me wrong, I ain't got nothing against peace songs or going to rallies to call for an end to the guns and the bombs. But in times like these, I feel compelled to declare my support for the ongoing escalation of the war effort. This ain't no peace song. This is a declaration of war, and this ain't no sing-along. This is the rise of a mighty roar. When the towers came down, everyone looked around for a culprit. And the media moguls and corporate elites took the pulpit. Ain't no fault of ours if all these millions are angry. Living in rubble and crumbling hovels in poverty. And draped in a flag, they are pointing away at their enemies. United we stand, they say, cleverly shirking complicity. Don't ask any questions, just follow us, we will show you the way. Rise up, America, come bomb another impoverished nation today. This ain't no peace song. This is a declaration of war, and this ain't no sing-along. This is the rise of a mighty roar. bombs hit the ground, tell me, what do you see? Are the ones calling the shots your friends or your enemies? Who are the victims? Who are the innocent? And who commits crimes? And who gets to spin it the next day on the cover of the New York Times? And furthermore, if I may ask, who are they anyway? Who can give us our freedom, and then with one vote they can take it all away? Well, I do declare they've exceeded their share of the oxygen, and we will not stand for one more command from their lips again. This ain't no peace song. This is a declaration of war, and this ain't no sing-along. This is the rise of a mighty roar. An eye for an eye will leave us all blind, I have heard it said. Yes, but peace without justice and struggle will surely leave a million more dead. So stand up on your feet and take to the streets. This is no time for fear. Call us traitors or spies and spread all your lies, but we will persevere. It's been said before and I'll say it once more. Let's bring the war home and battle the forces of greed and injustice wherever they may roam. And united we'll stand in this land of hypocrisy, to take back our lives from the rulers and build a democracy. This ain't no peace song. This is a declaration of war, and this ain't no sing-along. This is the rise of a mighty roar. No more will we stand idly by while they ravage the earth and hurl flame from the sky. No more will be silenced, no more will be still, no more will be pillaged, no more will be killed. No more silent vigils, this time we will roar, we'll call out the traitors, and we will declare war on the oil executives, corporate elites, Wall Street vigilantes in mountain retreats, IMF bureaucrats, Monsanto thugs, CIA agents with taps and with bugs, rich greedy landlords and real estate crooks, corporate lawyers with corporate law books, fascists in the White House and fools on the Hill, uniformed puppets with guns set to kill, racist Avengers and Pentagon brutes, slick politicians and bankers in suits, own money, new money, privileged few, owners of Nike, Chevron and GQ, pesticide pushers of chemical war, econ departments, Walmart superstores, kings and their armies and princes and dukes, religious zealots who kill for the truth, free trade agreements and global control, smokestacks and gasoline and ozone holes. This ain't no peace song.